This is URN.
The Film Show Breakdown.
Hello everyone and welcome back to The Film Show. It is our penultimate episode. And this week we are just going to do a quick catch-up. Well, I say quick. We're going to do a straightforward, a straightforward catch-up of the films that have been released so far this year that we have not got a chance to talk about. Primarily, we will be focusing on The King of Staten Island and The Five Bloods. We are going to start off, though, I believe. Hold on, who's with me? First up.
Joseph.
And
Isaac.
And Joseph, I believe you have some film news.
Yeah, so three different pieces of film news, very different pieces of film news as well. First of all, the sad news that came out in the last hour or so about the passing of Ian Holm, the iconic British actor.
Oh, is that why? Yeah. I didn't realise. Yeah. I saw a montage.
I just found out just a few minutes ago.
I saw a collage of his most famous roles on Twitter and I didn't put two and two together. So obviously there was Bilbo Baggins.
His Oscar-nominated role in Chariots of Fire.
There's Alien.
And Alien as well, yeah. They're the main ones anyway.
Actually a fantastic... bit of a chameleon, to be honest with you, when I was looking at the montage. But yeah, go on, sorry.
Yeah, so,
Rest
in peace to him and respect to his family at this difficult time. Second piece of news, the Academy of Motion Arts and Sciences said that the Oscars are going to be moved to April next year rather than in February and March.
Let's give them more time.
Allows eligibility up to February rather than December 31st. Because if you know how Oscars work, you have to have a week screening in New York or Los Angeles. So that has been changed as well because it's straight streaming can be allowed.
Yeah, I was going to say that as well.
But so, like, what about for example, The Five Bloods will be eligible this year,
and it probably will be nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
It'll be nominated for quite a few, but we'll get onto that in due course. But I think that's the right move because of obvious reasons. It allows films that are, you know, primarily cinematic releases rather than anything else that can't really go to VOD.
But Joseph,
instead,
what does this mean for 2021? Is 2021 going to be a 10-month year for the Academy? So for the following Oscars?
That's a very good question, actually.
It is. I don't think they've thought that through yet, to be
honest. They might just have to.
It wouldn't surprise me.
They might just have to suck it up.
I do think the streaming thing will end up going through from long term because I feel like most films won't go to cinematic release anyway. By the time we see cinemas reopen, it's going to be all of the big summer blockbusters coming in like October, November, December time. And, you know, they'll all be competing at the same time. So, like, the independent films won't get any screens anyway. So they might as well just all go independent. And I think that will be the trend.
As a quick reminder,
It's often been the case of guaranteed profit.
As a quick reminder, Joseph, what big blockbusters have we missed out on?
So far we've already missed, well, the Bond film moved to October.
No Time to Die.
Yeah, there's Mulan that was supposed to be released, I think, in like April, I think. Tenet has been the film that's been very, very strict on not moving its release date, but even that's moved by 2 weeks to the end of July now. I think still that's a bit ambitious, to be honest.
End of July.
Yeah,
how is that even possible?
I don't know. It's just the insistence of Chris Nolan to he won't put it in VOD, and he still wants a summer release for it.
And the cinemas, when cinemas do open, they're probably going to have a distancing, like a social distancing guidelines in place, so there'll be less tickets available.
But the regulations are in place for cinemas to reopen on, I think, July 17th, I believe.
But there's going to be less tickets per screen, right?
Yeah, for sure. But you know what Chris Nolan's like. He's very...
Wow.
He's very strict on insisting on big screens for his...
I can understand, for a Christopher Nolan fan such as myself, it's like, I understand it not going to VOD, because I would personally want to see a Christopher Nolan movie first on VOD, but if that would mean it'd be delayed by a few months, that would be okay. I don't know why it needs to stay in July.
Watched a trailer for Tenet, and I gotta say, the world looks a bit too clean, like a bit too sterile, sorry if that makes sense.
Like, I can see what you mean.
It looks too perfect. Like a lot of Christopher Nolan movies, the environments sort of look a bit, sometimes deliberately, they're a bit too glossy, a bit too polished. Like it, and it works in films like Inception, where you're in like a dream. But I feel like sometimes, especially when you're dealing with like the grimier Gotham City, Dunkirk. Well, it wasn't as bad as Dunkirk.
I think would be a prime example.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad.
But it's clean beast, isn't it?
It's the same. It's the same issue. It's the same issue of it just being too perfect. And for this film, it's the first time where I feel like it's dragged down my excitement for it, because I'm just looking for it, and it all looks really bizarrely too coordinated and perfect. I don't know.
Oh, we'll have to just wait and see.
Yeah.
It might not be.
You can't judge until you see the
film. It might work in the actual film itself. But yeah, I'm going to watch it anyway. Yeah.
One final piece of film news. There was a new trailer for a film that looks fantastic called Palm Springs. This played at the Sundance Film Festival, and it stars Andy Samberg in the lead role. Andy Samberg's been away from film for a while because he plays a lead role in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Yep. So he returns to the big screen after iconic roles in like Popstar, Never Stopping, and Hot Rod. So it's good to see him back on screen. It's sort of like a fantasy kind of
Groundhog Day.
Yeah, it's Groundhog Day, but in Palm Springs. So basically, it's sort of like go down this wormhole, and then you end up waking up in the same place in Palm Springs, time and time again, no matter what happens during that day. And so you can like die in loads of different ways, and then you're still in trying to escape, but you still end up.
Oh, is it like a more deliberate Groundhog Day? Like you choose to go there?
No, as in like you can't get out of it. So you can get out of like your day, but you're gonna wake up in Palm Springs. If that makes sense, you have to watch the trailer to get the concept. But in terms of, I'm pretty much hooked on that concept. I think it would make for a good film, and very reliable sources from that have seen it in Sundance said it was excellent and one of the best of that film festival. So
it's very promising.
You know what Lonely Island are up to, you know, they've always got some kind of wacky plan. Mm-hmm.
When's it really scheduled to be released? On July 10th
July.
Streaming service Hulu. Okay.
Yeah, Hulu.
We'll see.
They're getting into the film game because they broke out with their original TV series with Handmaid's Tale, which won. So Hulu actually was the first streaming service to win an Emmy for best drama series before like Netflix or Amazon, despite them having a much bigger head start. So. Oh,
what a steal! So Hulu is
probably
the,
kicking in with the original film.
Getting the license to Handmaid's Tale, what an absolute steal that was.
Absolutely, yeah.
So is that all our film news?
Yeah.
Well, we can give... Oh, we've got like a solid 10 minutes or so for The King of Staten Island.
All right.
Who would like to explain the plot?
Yeah, I'll do that. So The King of Staten Island is about a 24-year-old called Scott, played by Pete Davidson, as he sort of comes to terms with sorting out his life. His dad died at a young age when he was 7, his sister started moving to college, and his mom, played by Marissa Tomei, gets a new boyfriend, and sort of like all these things coming together basically tell Scott to sort his life out, move out, get a job. He's an aspiring tattoo artist, and he's sort of like just lazing around in Staten Island and sort of needs to get his life together. That's the premise.
Would you say it's sort of a slice of life, meandering sort of film?
Definitely meandering. It sort of like plays on how much you enjoy being in this world with these characters. But ultimately, I feel like I'm sort of shortchanged by what was promised sort of for this film.
But just to clarify, you don't mean meandering as like an insult or a critique. It's just a style of storytelling.
No, I think you know what you're going in for with a Judd Apatow film. You know, you see the runtime of 136 minutes for a comedy. Sort of like you're expecting that, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's not going to be flat out jokes the whole time, is it? But I think with its lacking of emotional value, it makes that sort of not effective in its time. So if you think of a film like Superbad, which is another Apatow co-production, a film that he produced, that film uses its runtime excellently because it has a firm structure of the, it's about 24 to 36 hours, a day in a life sort of thing of these characters. And so that has a really good structure to it. While with King Staten Island, there's no real beginning or end. It's just sort of things sort of happen. And it ends up being sort of like a therapy session more than anything for Pete Davidson, rather than anything that's sort of gonna be notable as anything other than that. I feel like, you know how you have the Bechdel test for for talking about not talking about men when two named women characters talk to each other.
Yeah.
I think you can have it for this film where you have two characters that are not talking about Pete Davidson's character. It's sort of like it's like his commentary on the world.
Do you think that you were comparing it to other Judd Apatow films like Superbad, do you think the film would work better if it was like a day of the life in his character to give it some more structure rather than it being beyond a day?
I think so. I'm not too sure. I think if you're putting it into a category, it's very similar to This Is 40 and Trainwreck in terms of the way that it portrays its characters as being these really sort of troubled characters, even though stuff they do doesn't really make sense. That's the biggest issue, I think, because it's portraying this sort of like millennial kind of lifestyle. But what it does is sort of, it doesn't explore that enough. There's so many interesting aspects to you could explore with this sort of case study in terms of dealing with grief, having no direction in life, still living at home at a young age, not being able to get a job, having no real life ambitions. And it doesn't really do that in any way. There's no real commentary on it. And then sort of like the stuff that he does just doesn't make any sense. So there's... I don't want to go spoiling it too much in terms of what happens, but there's a scene where he's sort of like kicked out of the house and he's sort of trying to find a place to stay. And the assumption is that he doesn't have enough money to live anywhere or to go. So he's sort of like going around the street or using people to stay in the house and stuff like that. Like, this is a guy that can afford a car but doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's like, how can he afford to have a car?
So does the struggle not really
and
feel
doesn't go anywhere?
The struggle doesn't another, really feel another... authentic.
I don't think it's not about being authentic. I just feel like this film had so much potential to be a certain thing. So like, there's a scene in the trailer, right, where he's walking a kid to school, which is his mom's new boyfriend's kids. And there's a scene in the trailer where he says to her, I like talking to you because you're one of the few people that treat me like a person.
Yeah.
I feel like that's such a really smart line and such a really sweet line, because it's sort of like you get that interaction between people and it says about how misunderstood people can be when they have mental health difficulties, and talking to people is very important with that. But that scene's not in the film. That line's not in the film. So you get scenes where he's walking to school with them, but it doesn't really go anywhere with that. There's the scene that you also see in the trailer where he's in the school classroom, and the teacher's sort of asking, do you know this man? Because he looks dodgy, right? Because he looks like a junkie, because he's heavily tattooed and a weed addict. I prepped her in the car. Yeah, but you didn't drive her to school, mate. This doesn't make any sense. So, it's just...
I saw that joke in the trailer. Yeah, I remember that.
Another question I have for you, Joseph. Like, the film is called The King of Staten Island, and I'm thinking, from the top of my head, there's not... Even with some of my favourite films, both in the past and present, that are set in New York, I can't really think of a movie, but even a segment or a scene of a movie that's set in Staten Island. It's usually Manhattan or Brooklyn or Once in a While Queens. So how does the film depict Staten Island?
Well, hello, my name is Doris, which we were talking about briefly a couple of weeks ago when we did the Michael Showalter Kumail Nanjiani partnership special. I think that's set in Staten Island, I believe. But I think what it does, it sort of... It has no real say on it, because there's a character played by Belle Powley who's sort of believes that she can make Staten Island great again. So it's sort of like a better place to live sort of thing. But in doing so, going to work in New York, that doesn't make much sense. Its environment is sort of like, it's a place that you sort of want to be in, because it's sort of like, it doesn't lose your attention throughout the film. I mean, it's a long runtime and stuff, but you don't sort of like think like, oh, I wish I was watching something else. It's just on a narrative level, what have I gained from this experience? What direction does this film go in? And what does it tell me about Pete Davidson's character? And it doesn't really do much with it.
Bel Powley was in M.I. High.
Well, yeah, but Bel Powley is a fantastic actress.
The CBBC show.
she does the best that she can in this role, but it is very typical, you know, British portraying a working-class American performance.
Yeah.
In terms of, you've got that accent. I think she's a lot more, you know, I can't think of the right word, but sort of, if you've seen some of her performances, so if you've seen stuff like The Morning Show, you know sort of what accent she kind of has. And
oh, it's The Morning Show that
is very out of
it.
That kind of comfort zone.
Apple TV. TV show, yeah.
She plays a British character in that, so sort of, you know what kind of accent she has and the sort of accents she uses in this film. It's good, but it's sort of like, but their relationship in the film doesn't really make much sense. And that's sort of meant to be the whole rooting factor of it, where you want them to get back together, but you don't really see what's the point. The reason that they're not together is because of these mental health issues that Pete Davidson's character has. If they'd have explored that a little bit more, I feel like this could have been so much better than it actually is.
So you've said a lot of negatives, Joseph. Is there anything you have positive to say?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it's a terrible film by any means, but it's very much a 5 or 6 out of 10, to be honest. I think there are funny segments. There's a scene where you have the new boyfriend character. Before that happens, he basically, Pete Davidson's character tattoos his kid in the woods without his permission, sort of thing. And the dad, well, with his permission, but the dad comes around and is angry about it. And there's a really great scene there where his sort of like comic timing comes in. It's when Pete Davidson doesn't get to do sort of like improv, or sort of like goes out of his this like scripted way and acts with instincts, where it's actually quite funny. The music is fantastic as well. I really like the music. It just has really, really good songs for those sort of scenes. And it's never boring. I wasn't bored by it, but I just wasn't sort of intrigued, or it didn't move me in any way, which I think it needs to, really, for it to work completely. I saw a comment on the underneath the YouTube video of Mark Kermode's review for the film last Friday, and he said, oh, self-indulgent, or that's just every Judd Apatow film. So it's really not. And I thought, like, this was before I'd seen the film, and I sort of like, that's just completely the wrong way of looking at his films, because I don't think that's at all. But then when I saw this film, I sort of like, it's got a point, you know. This is pretty self-indulgent, to be fair, and it doesn't need to be. It can have a positive message, and ultimately, you feel somewhat shortchanged, which is an issue when you're charging £14 to rent this film.
I think that is an issue with a lot of VOD films that have come out, is that I think people don't understand that that's not a good price to pay. Like if a film is, like, for me, like when I brought a few films recently on VOD, if they're like in the £4-£55 range, I'll be sure. Like, that's fine, because that's how much I'd pay a ticket. But if I'm going to watch something for £15, I'm like, no, I wouldn't pay that kind of money.
I get the point of what they're doing. They're sort of like, oh, if two people had seen this in a cinema, they would have paid that much.
Yeah, I understand.
It's a very different experience.
Mm-hmm. And is it just to rent, did you say, for 15?
Well, either rent or buy it. There's no option to do either sort of thing.
The rent one should be much cheaper.
For sure, yeah. It should be £5 maximum for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not sort of like delivering on the sort of the promise of the film, or what the film should be about, and what the film should do, then you can't really be charging that price.
I think it's arrogance, really. I think it's
absolutely very... yeah. And it's pricing out, you know, the standard people that would actually get something out of this film. When you're portraying working class lives like the film does, let working class people see it.
We'll have to wrap that up there. That's right. I really like that perspective.
Very
on
shame
it,
to see you, Joseph. I know you're a big
It's disappointing because this was one of my most anticipated films of the year, and it's just a little bit underwhelming. I don't think it's terrible by any means. If you're a fan of Judd Apatow, if you're a fan of Pete Davidson, I'd definitely recommend checking this out because I feel like there's a lot to be gained if you perceive it in the right way. It doesn't hit the mark for me.
I was just gonna say I'm not much of a Judd Apatow fan. I just don't find his films that appealing.
I think he's got worse over the years. Like, but there is exceptions like The Big Sick we reviewed a couple of weeks ago. That's perfectly structured, perfectly toned, and that's what you get when you portray sort of like that sort of like quasi biopic sort of thing in the right way because it's got smart writing and it understands its character.
And Kumail was playing himself.
Yeah, it's got direction to it. It's got a really good structure to it, and by the time it ends, you feel like I'm satisfied with what I've seen. King Staten Island, I'm not so much. I'm not so sure.
Oh, very good. We'll have to call it there. After the break, we will be reviewing The Five Bloods. Now we're going to discuss The Five Bloods by Spike Lee, a Spike Lee joint. Would anyone like to describe the plot, or shall I?
Yeah, you can if you want.
So, four African-American Vietnam veterans return to Vietnam to find the remains of their old squad leader and the gold that was hidden with him. Joining them in their journey is one of the former soldiers' sons. I'll explain that well. Joining them is one of their sons who has a frayed relationship with his father, and it turns from a road trip movie with Vietnam War style film flashbacks into a sort of a modern take spliced in with an adventure film. Tonally and in terms of genre, it's very daring in trying to mix a lot at once. Yeah. And I sort of really enjoyed that aspect of it. Like I said in the group chat, I enjoyed it for the Vietnam War / modern road trip film that it is. But yeah, I won't go into any more specific plot details because I think the setup is interesting enough to launch the discussion. I don't want to spoil too much. So first, I think I will... What did you guys think? Will I bring up what I want to read out? What's your initial impressions of The Five Bloods?
For me, it was sort of like... I didn't really enjoy watching it, but I have a lot of admiration for what it does. I think for the first hour or so, it's pretty slow and hard to get into, a lot of respect.
That was my favourite part of it, to be honest.
It literally blows into life about an hour and a half in, and then for the last hour, it's pretty...
So my problem with that is, it's... Okay, a big actual problem with the film is its portrayal of modern Vietnam, which people have complained about online. It's not very fair, and it's very critical and a very American perspective. But, you know, I get it works for the sort of, like, adventure film tone that it develops into.
It's not entertaining enough to be an adventure film.
It's not a family film, I'm saying, in the sense of...
It's not entertaining at all.
I'm saying in the sense of they literally go on from their perspective an adventure.
Yeah.
But what I mean is there is some real tonal whiplash, and I'm glad you said that, Joseph, because it's very relevant to what I'm going to say. They are basically at the end of they're on a mission, sure, but they're basically four retired guys on holiday, and some of the more action based consequences of the journey just sometimes jumps out of nowhere.
Doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
Like, they have one gun between all of them, and then all of a sudden they're shooting machine guns.
It's strange, but there is a logic break there, and now it makes a lot more sense to people why Vietnam had to be betrayed the way it is. Modern Vietnam had to be betrayed the way it is because they needed a sense of lawlessness to it when they get into the second part of the film, the action adventure part of the film. Again, I'm not tonally. I'm not saying it tries to be a family film. Don't go. Expect to be shocked in terms, like, visually and in terms of tone and content.
Yeah, it actually makes you feel very uncomfortable in a lot of places. I'd like the watching experience of being something of like Beast of No Nation or 12 Years a Slave in terms of how difficult it is to watch at times. How sort of like you don't ever feel comfortable with the film's company.
I'm struggling to express how I both enjoyed the hybrid of it and was uncomfortable and confused by the logic of it at the same time. I want to read out what I asked Ben his opinion on either of the two films we were talking about today. And I'll read out what he said. He couldn't be with us right now, unfortunately, in case you haven't guessed. He said he really couldn't get along with it. I'd praise the camera work for the action sequences and Chadwick Boseman. The first 3 minutes are very reminiscent of the opening sequence to Reznai's Hiroshima Mon Amour. Did I pronounce that right? Haven't seen an opening that graphic for a while. So what he's referring to is an opening montage that has a lot of real-life horrible instances spliced into it. And if you've seen Black Klansman, you know the end of that film suddenly pulls back into a real-life perspective. And this is me talking now. I get what Spike Lee is going for when he does this, and it works really well in Black Klansman because of the tone of the film established before it, and the story has already been told, so we can pull back into a real-world montage. But I do agree with Joseph saying this film can be uncomfortable, and I think a lot of the real-world horrors spliced into it is part of that. Because it's literally, it cuts away to a straight up frame of an actual horrible thing from the Vietnam War in the middle of what still essentially feels like a road trip film. And it's really, you can tell a story about the atrocities of war without actually consistently using footage from it. Like, it's not like the rest of the film has a documentary feel. Like, you know how some films, even though they're fictional, they have like a more documentary feel to them. Like they're made by a documentary filmmaker or whatever. I'm trying to think of what a famous example of that is. I'll remember in a second. But yeah, what do you guys think of the real world inclusion of stuff?
I think, again, with Joseph, I think I admire this film more than I kind of like, unlike Black Klansman, where I was like on the edge of my seat and I absolutely adore that film. Like, again, I think Mark promoted it in his review, like, unlike Black Klansman, where, like, you know, the more modern aspect, especially the ending, feels very natural and very understandable. Like, but even though, like, isolated, like, both present and scene set in the past work, they don't feel as natural. Like, they try to transition them, but it still doesn't feel, they feels like two separate films. Even though it has the same characters, and I think some of the best things about the film is the camaraderie between the veterans. I think they're very, it feels very lived in, and you feel their squabbles and you feel their kind of camaraderie and the good and the chemistry between them all, especially what's the name of the actor,
which character, Isaac?
Sorry, I'll just be a sec.
What character are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of Delroy Lindo.
Now,
he was the highlight of the film to me. Like, even though he says a lot of, like, you know, he says and does a lot of horrible stuff, you do feel the most invested in his character because he's so well, it's so well performed. Like, even when the film's at its weaker elements, like, he's pulling it so much. Like, you could feel the conflict and a kind of, you know, the two-sidedness of his character.
He keeps it together, and by the time he gets to the reveal, it's so effective.
Yeah, like the beginning, you think he's going to be the comic relief because he's like all talking about Trump and build that wall, and he wears a Make America Great hat, makes America Great Again hat, you know, and you think it's all just comic relief. But then when you kind of descend further into madness in the jungle, it gets very dark.
As soon as there's like a hint of violence, he just becomes a different beast entirely. Yeah. It's crazy. I think this performance is the level of a Forrest Whitaker in Last King of Scotland or a Denzel Washington in Training Day, that level of kind of intensity and sort of strength and magnetism. I think it's unbelievable, this performance. It's one of the best performances I've seen in years.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's the highlight. And also, even though he's not as much in the film, Chadwick Boseman, you know, worked very well. Like, obviously, he's sort of the charisma he has naturally as an actor. It plays into the film, and it's kind of this, when you first see him in a photo when they're in the hotel, he very much is kind of on a throne, like he is as Black Panther. Yeah. But when they go to the flashback scenes, which I think are very clever, not just because they're well shot or it feels like one of those kind of First Blood Part 2 ripoffs that you might find in the 80s, you know, shot on 16mm, it's square framed. But what I kind of really respected about the film is that when they go flashbacks, you know, the surviving Bloods aren't like de-aged, their age.
I think
that doesn't
fantastic.
Work. It's kind of a respect as an audience. Like, yeah, you know, if you're with this film, you'll just accept the fact that, you know, they're the younger versions. But also, the way it's filmed, you know, it's like more of an action film. It's more kind of exhilarating. You know, the actual action is actually done really well.
I disagree with you, Isaac. I don't think you are supposed to think they're the younger versions. Well, obviously they are.
No, no, that's what I was about to say.
Right?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'm saying even though they're flashbacks, obviously I think the film like obviously shows that this is them looking at roasted into glasses again.
Yeah.
The action's more exhilarating, it's more visceral. And, you know, and Chadwick Boseman, both what he says and how he's depicted, like visually, like it is very much like he is like a true mentor. He's almost like you know, beyond, like he's more than a man, you know, he's a leader.
Yeah.
And I think the film did that really well. If that was just the whole film and with that same tone approach, I would think that would be really great. And again, if they were still, you know, they hadn't been de-aged one bit. I think also interesting, because my dad a few years ago went to Vietnam on holiday, and he told me when he went there that a lot of the Vietnamese call it the American War, which I think is a very interesting thing. I think that's a nice little nod. Yeah, they don't call it the Vietnam War because, you know, they see it as the Americans coming in. Also, a great thing about the film is obviously it's a bit more of a personal thing, but I really like the usage of Marvin Gaye. Not just because, you know, what's going on, both the song and the album is one of the best albums and songs like ever made. Like, it actually works well with the character, especially with Lindo's character, you know, especially sort of, you know, later in the film, there's like a scene where he sings one of the songs on the album, and it's just really, we know what's going to happen now.
It's not just like, there's that one sequence where we're catching up with, I won't spoil who's where, but we're cutting between two different sets of people, and there's the isolated Marvin Gaye vocal performance being played. Yeah. Like, there's no music behind it, and it's just really fantastic. And I've seen it being described as the best use of Marvin Gaye in film ever, and I couldn't agree more.
I can't think of any other movie that does it as well, honestly.
Yeah, the de-aging thing to go back to, because I'm really sorry. I should say not the de-aging thing, because I'm really impressed with what that choice, because even though it's such a simple choice, it represents so much about the psychology of the modern day characters. When they think back to it, they're not actually reminiscing of being their younger selves or reliving the glory of war. They are picturing them as themselves, and they're still in the action, like they are haunted by it. I think it's quite a good, despite how glossed up it is, it's also a good representation of like PTSD, because they see as themselves still living out the war, and obviously they have their idyllic soldier of a commander that they have a lot of regret and guilt about dying at this time, and I think it's a really fantastic representation of that.
I think my favorite sort of segment of the film is kind of, I don't know, about an hour in, when they do find, spoilers, they do actually find the gold.
Yeah.
And you know, that's very, it's a great little moment where they find the gold, and you know, they, all this work, they, well, not that much work, but like, you know, they finally got what they came for. But then like, it goes from sort of this sort of joyous and sort of adventure, like it, then it goes, then they figure out, oh yeah, also, you know, Storm and Norman's, you know, his remains are here. And when it, when they finally do find his remains, it is just, there's like the shot of all of them together. It's just, it, that is like really powerful. I think that's the most powerful moment in the film, is when they find him.
I do think that, so with all action adventure films, which is, this is listed as much as there's some dispute over that, with all action adventure films, there is, that what happens to the characters should never be as important. So it is always more important than the actual action itself, and the action is just used to tell a story. And but I felt in this film, I felt that more than I should have done. Like, it was very obvious that Spike Lee didn't actually care about the action sequences. And like I say, of course, what happens to the characters is more important.
I think in the present day,
yeah, I'm talking about the present day.
He does film action really well.
I'm talking about the present day. I'm literally, without spoiling it, I'm talking about the resolution of the film itself.
Oh, that final, okay.
Well, and the build up to it, and the scene with all, when they get out of the jungle, and with all the, not spoiling who's there, but with all the cars and stuff. And the first proper modern day action sequence, if you remember what I'm talking about, it all felt a bit out of place. But like I say, it worked to move the characters forward. And what does happen to the characters, I think, is a satisfying resolution. What do you say, Joseph?
It's a difficult one. That's a difficult one.
It's difficult to talk about without spoiling, yeah.
But not just difficult to say without spoiling, but I think it's a difficult one to talk about ethically as well. Like, price of life versus price of anything else. I mean, there's a line that's saying, like, the bloods don't die, they multiply, sort of thing. And that's about, that's how it links it sort of like to modern day issues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
For that reason, it's sort of like, it allows Spike Lee to make it relevant to now, and I feel like it's come out at a good time to do that, but whether it's a satisfactory ending, I'm not so sure.
I was talking about in the break, I think, that I feel like Black Klansman told its own story that still felt relevant to today, and then I think I talked about during the actual show itself how that made the montage much more effective. One thing I will say about this film is it's really insistent about how relevant it is to today.
Yeah.
If that makes... Well, I think Black Klansman is a much better film and is much more powerful for it, yeah.
Yeah, Black Klansman is one of the best films.
Because the thing with the Five Bloods is that... I was talking about a bit of research into it, because by the time you get the end credits, you see it's written by four people, or two sets of two people.
Yeah.
Because it was originally supposed to be made about white vets, and was written for Oliver Stone to direct. And Spike Lee came in and rewrote it to make it about black veterans instead. And it's sort of like, because of that, it loses out quite a bit in terms of, just because it's been rewritten so many times, it loses its kind of like tight structure. The thing is with Black Klansman, it's sort of what that does so well is that it's so tight. It has a really good beginning, middle, and end. You follow the characters in a really good motion in terms of the rising tension as well. It's sort of like the main thing happens halfway through, and then it sort of goes a bit crazy. And then, with the exception of one particular scene, which I think is massively important to understanding everything that's come before it, especially in regards to PTSD, it's all a bit messy. And when before that, when it was properly structured, it was a bit dull. Sort of like those things put together make it a bit of a tough one to sort of decide whether it's been successful or not. I think for what it is, it's good. Like, I think it's a solid four out of five kind of film. But I don't know. It's not a film I want to watch again.
If I had to give it a numerical rating, I would probably give it a 3.5.
Yeah,
but I still think it's above average. It's definitely worth at least trying. But if you can't feel yourself getting into it, like, that's fine.
I can see it being a big awards contender, though. I think Delroy Lindo is the guy to beat for best actor this year. I think you have to better his performance if you want to win. It's going to be a tough ask. But
if I could also quickly say, it was good to see the actor Jonathan Majors, who plays Lindo's son. Like, he was in a film, Before She Falls, for a long time, my favorite film of last year, Last Black Man in San Francisco. So it's good to see him get work. And obviously, he does a very good performance in this film as well. I'd say one more criticism, which is a shame, like, because I used to, like, I think the changes in aspect ratio, and not from, you know, present day to the past when it goes, but when it goes from, you know, the sort of widescreen when they're in sort of, you know, the cities in Vietnam, for when they go into like the countryside when it goes to 185, that didn't make much sense to me.
I quite like the way that it was done, though, in terms of the editing transition is good for that, which made it work.
Maybe it's just personal preference.
I didn't mind that, because I just find it more comfortable watching a film that's like full and it takes up the full screen rather than having the black bars. That's just personal preference.
One final criticism I will say is, because I don't know if I said it before the show, but I don't know if I said it in the actual recording, is I feel like this film could have done with another draft in the edit suite. I feel that he does have some pacing issues, but I didn't really. You don't feel it for the whole thing, so it doesn't make the film unwatchable.
It's not as much of a slog as it could have been.
No.
Could have very easily been a slog because of the amount of walking in it.
But yeah, I'd recommend it. Absolutely. I think a lot of people are going
to
be talking about it.
I'd recommend it to anyone who's watching it for like a... Yeah, I think it's another film that you have to put in a right frame of mind. I remember when we reviewed The Irishman, and I feel like it's a similar response to that. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you've got to be in the right frame of mind, you've got to be switched on. And you've got to recognise that there's going to be some tough stuff to watch, and it's going to expose some real difficult issues, and you've got to be comfortable with that.
That's a good comparison. Isaac, would you recommend it?
I would say I'd recommend, you know, give it a shot. You know, it's like, say what you will about sort of the quality of it. Like, it doesn't seem like a film that's doesn't have passion, or doesn't seem what's the word, passion, but also it has a sense of sort of it has conviction. Whether it's fully successful in doing it as a film, I don't fully know. I don't think it's fully successful, but I would say give it a shot if you're a fan of Spike Lee, or if you're interested in maybe a different perspective of Vietnam on film, because I don't think I've seen a Vietnam film with this kind of perspective. Or just a Vietnam film in general. It's been a very long time since one's been released, you know, to a wide audience. Yeah.
All right, fantastic. Next up, we're going to discuss the best films of 2020 so far. A big pool to choose from. So, is there any films that we haven't talked about this year that you guys think need a special shout-out?
I have one film I'll talk about. Try to talk about quickly. I think the best film I've seen so far that actually is from 2020 and not just a late release is the Assistant. I know it played in some festivals last year, but it did get a cinema release in America and then obviously got a release here in the UK via VOD. It's written and directed by Kitty Green, who's sort of mostly well known in documentaries, and you kind of see that in the film. Like, it feels very, you know, slice of life, but it feels very grounded and real. The film follows sort of, as the title suggests, an assistant played by Julia Garner, who most people would know from the show Ozark, and she's sort of works at this film production company in New York, and sort of you kind of see her daily kind of routine, like literally from work. Like, it starts from like 5 a.m, like when New York is like sort of, you know, hasn't woken up to, you know, when she's, you know, like right before she right after she leaves for work. And it's just, it is maybe the best horror film I've seen this year. Like, I think a weird comparison I thought about when I was watching it is that it reminded me of the Chernobyl miniseries. And even though they're about two very different things, you know, one being about the Chernobyl disaster, one being about sort of, you know, harassment in many forms, not just in the film industry, but just, you know, in all work, is that it feels like even though there is like a figure, you know, a sort of, you know, a sort of a film mogul type figure who, you know, shouts and screams, and obviously the film's very unsettled about who it's referencing, but you never see this person. And I think that's a very clever move, because it shows that even though it's like that it's this one person, it doesn't feel like it's too specific or too kind of narrow. It feels very universal in a very saddening way. And, you know, there's a lot of microaggressions, sort of subtle things, you know, subtle little things that just, it just keeps piling up and piling up.
Do we actually see the boss?
No, you never see the boss. You hear the boss, and you see, and but you never, you can never, you never have a clear view of who he is. And sort of my, maybe one of the best scenes I've seen, maybe my favorite scene from this year, is after, you know, sort of figuring out what's going on, she tries to go to HR, and even though Julie Garner is really great as she's the lead, you know, Matthew McGriff, I can't pronounce his name, last name. How do you pronounce it, Joseph?
Who's this?
In Quiz, he was in the...
Matthew McFadden.
Yeah, he's sort of the HR guy. And it's very much, it, like, from what some think that should be about, you know, helping people, turns into like a Room 101. Like, he basically just assassinates her character, and she's just crying. And she's just, it shows that, like, this whole you know, the industry and the system that she's working in is so rotten and so corrupt. And it is like, it's like he's basically saying, like, yeah, you could do this, but it's going to, you know, your career's not going to work out. You know, he's like, you know, say you're smart. You know, it's what she hears a lot. You're smart. You know what to do, that kind of thing, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And it's just, it is really oppressive. The film is very gray, it's very drab. Like, usually I have an issue with films that are shot, like, especially films shot digitally, where they're very, you know, wet and drab and don't really have much to it, like, visually. But this film, it actually works in its favor. Like, all the colors are just zapped out, muted. Like, there's a, when she's having, like, these kind of colored Cheerios, you know, they're not even, you know, even though they have color, they're just completely devoid of kind of any kind of vibrancy or saturation. And it is very depressing. Like, I wouldn't say it's for everybody, but I think, again, it's just a day in the life of this person. You feel that this is not something that's new or fresh. It feels like just a regular thing she has to deal with every day. That even something as mild as, you know, getting a sandwich order wrong for her co-workers feels like a massive deal, you know, and they are, you know, say, just do little things, microaggressions that are just really awful.
I'm looking at some reviews now. Would you like to hear a criticism of the HR scene?
Sure. Is it unrealistic or?
So someone says 3.5. Someone who gave the film 3.5 stars and praised it up until this point said, "My one issue is the HR scene, which feels like it needs to be the film's best moment, but which didn't work for me. I suppose the point is to show the futility of this action, but it felt like both a raising of the stakes and disappointingly vague. This is where she's confronted the most directly with abuse. But why doesn't the film confront us as directly with what Jane is alleging? I feel like, based on the really thorough and specific characterization the film gives throughout, she would have needed a more concrete influence to motivate her action." What would you say to that, Isaac?
I would disagree. I think so throughout the film, she's meant to just be, you know, as assistant, but it's more than that. She becomes a cleaner. She, you know, mops up all sorts of things that I really don't. Luckily, they don't show in that much detail, but they kind of imply what it is in the office, in the boss's office, and like in the earring she picks up for somebody. I don't know. I think it again, it's not a very pleasant scene to watch, but I think it's very important, because again, like the person said in that review and the criticism, it shows the futility, but not like the film's approach is saying, "Oh, doesn't this suck? There's nothing we can do about it." I think the film, maybe less the text of the film, but the context shows that just how much needs to be changed in the workplace, not just in the film industry, but just workplaces in general. Again, this film can work for all sorts of industries. It's just one they've chosen. Again, it's a very rare thing where it's a film about the film industry, but one, it's set in New York and not Los Angeles. It's not like the massive, beautiful studios in LA. It's in just the office in New York that's just completely anonymous and just not, that could be for anything, you know, just lots of paperwork, lots of sort of NXL documents, lots of headshots, you know, nothing spectacular. And it doesn't just say, "Oh, look how, you know, like kind of, you know, even though it shows the seedy side, oh, but actually it's kind of, there's some glamour to it, like you do for even good films that do the film industry. Like, this film just shows it as just it's just so just corrupted and so poisonous in certain places. And it, but again, it shows the sort of universality of sort of microaggressions and sexual harassment and all sorts of horrible things. And again, I say it as a horror film. I know it's more, you consider it more of a drama or maybe even thriller aspects, but it is really a horror film, you know. And I would, if you're, I don't want to say it's a very pleasant, again, not a very pleasant viewing, but.
And it takes it place is a very over essential a, drawing. Takes place over a day, right?
Yeah, that's why, like, the film is very brisk. It's very to the point. Even in that daytime, it doesn't mess about. It's only 85 minutes. And it is very kind of, it has a rhythm to it, especially the opening where it's just her, you know, sort of, it's almost like this is a daily routine. You know, she turns on the light, she makes herself, you know, a cup of coffee, you know, she does all these sort of things. And then the last scene in the movie is like almost, not to spoil because it's out of context, but even something as simple as her getting a muffin in a cafe seems like, you know, a little triumph for, you know, the only thing that kind of, it is like Winston. She reminds me also with like Winston Smith in 1984. It's like this, that one thing that can keep someone going, even with all the sort of darkness out there. So for a film about such horrible subject matter, there is a glimmer of hope. And I think the film is meant to show that, hey, this isn't just about this one. It isn't just about this one person or about this studio. It is for all sort of employment. So I think it's not to say it's a, I would recommend it in the sense that it's like you would for, like, you know, I'm trying to make it like any kind of film I adore. I think it's a very necessary viewing and a very important viewing for a lot of people, especially if you are in employment or in places of power. Not to say the film is preachy in any way, like it has, you know, a structure, a narrative, characters. Yeah, so I would highly recommend. Sorry I've dragged on for too long. One criticism I have is that they do, Patrick Wilson makes a cameo in the film and he's kind of meant to play himself. I can't accept like that. So yeah, like, because I love Patrick Wilson. But yeah, the film's highly recommended and you can get it on most VOD services.
Does he do all bad?
Sorry?
Does he do anything bad?
No, he's just like it's just this mere present. No, he's just like one moment in an elevator, but just like him being, I was like, what's he doing in this film? It's just like,
well, that's quite he's important.
Not even, he's not even called Patrick Wilson, he's just called famous actor.
It's quite important, actually, because it goes to show all your favourite actors are involved in these worlds. A lot of them not directly, but they are. You know, some of them will be complicit in just turning a blind eye to it because that's just how the business works. It's kind of depressing. Yeah,
it is like a monster. It feels like the Office is a character in itself. Like, it's all-consuming, and it just doesn't let out.
Before we wrap up, is there any other films that we want to quickly shout out?
Yeah, there's a new two-part documentary series made through the ESPN Phase 30 series that's available to watch on BT Player if you have BT Sport, called Lance. It's about Lance Armstrong, as there has been so many kind of material based on him and the doping scandal and everything like that. But I feel like this has a different perspective on it. Because what it does is sort of like it goes through the high. So like the first episode is the rise, and then the second episode is the fall of Lance Armstrong. It has, instead of having sort of like proper archive footage, it's more created new footage by following him now and seeing what his life is like now, basically after settling all of his lawsuits and stuff. And also having pretty much everyone involved in his life and in, whether it be his family or his teammates and everyone involved in the doping scandal as talking heads, which I think is massively important. Because so you sort of switch between the two. You have archive footage only based on interviews or races from the Tour de France. I think what this film, this series does, is sort of understand the degree of the cover-up and how big someone can become bigger than a sport and how that sport has to protect it. So it's the biggest cheating scandal of all time in all sports. And so because Lance Armstrong was the first sort of like, he's like a Hollywood star. He's big. He was more famous than Hollywood stars. I mean, when I was growing up, he was probably the most famous sportsman on the planet. And that's not been seen before in cycling or since. he basically elevated that to a whole continent was interested in cycling that wasn't interested in it before. And so it talks about the degree of the cover-up and stuff and the number of lies told and how people connect to specific stories, especially with him. It was the whole idea of if you believe in fairy tales, you believe in miracles, you believe in Lance Armstrong. And when that's proven to be forced around lies and around cheating, it's sort of like, and it's just interesting to see how he is now, because all these other documentaries are made, or films like The Program, for example, the Stephen Frears film, are done like not with him considered. So it's not with his blessing, yeah, or with interviews with him. So you sort of see him now and you just see such little remorse, and sort of like, yes, it's like your fault for sort of believing in the story more than anything else. And I didn't tell any lies when it came to sort of like, It's Not About the Bikes, which was his famous book that he released, was a massive big seller in the early 2000s. And it's sort of like, I think I was thinking about it a lot, and I think I was sort of liking it to this kind of like clickbait kind of era we're in now, in terms of, oh, it's your fault for interpreting it as such a way, I don't have to deliver on that promise, sort of thing.
And, really frustrating, yeah.
And people want to believe in stuff, and when they see stuff like Lance Armstrong's story, then they're obviously going to connect to it. And you see such little remorse now, because he is completely truthful in everything that he says. Now it seems like that's all fine. There's no real apology from him, and he's still angry at like Floyd Landis for coming out and sort of like not being in sort of like a snake as such, but sort of like talking about it openly. And which started really kickstarted the investigation into it properly. And I don't know, it does feel like an ickiness to it, and you sort of get a lot of different perspectives on the story, and I think it's probably the most complete work surrounding the whole Samsung saga of all of the films that have been made about him. So I feel like this is a massive recommend if you're cycling or you're interested in this story. Look, I'm not a big cycling fan, but this story captures me. Like, I remember watching the whole of the Oprah interview when it came out in 2013, just because of how massive this was. It's the, like, one of the biggest sporting stories of all time, one of the biggest misconceptions of all time. It goes into real detail with that. So if you're interested in those kind of things, I'd definitely recommend watching those two films.
Remind us what it's called.
Lance,
and Isaac's was the assistant. All right, guys, thank you very much, and thank you all for listening. Stay safe.
Cheers. See ya.
Oof. I will stop. Stop that recording, then stop my...